Hi, this is Phil Migliorati with Pray for Surf, and I'm talking with John Stebbins, who at the time of our recording has just released an incredible new book called The Beach Boys in Concert, The Ultimate History of America's Band on Tour and on Stage. John, thanks for taking the time to talk with me.
Well, thanks for having me, Phil. And let's make sure we give Ian Rustin credit. This was his book as well, and he's the one who really got the ball rolling on the project, so I don't want to be give anybody the impression that it's just my book.
I appreciate you pointing that out. In fact, that's a good place to start. How did you get into this? You mentioned Ian may have had the thoughts earlier. Just give us a sense of how this, an amazing tome of wonderful information we'll talk about, but how did it start?
Well, if you knew Ian, you'd have a better sense of why and how something like this could be achieved, because Ian is just an incredibly tenacious researcher with just such an attention to detail that it borders on insanity. And you know, he'll get a laugh out of that because he has that obsessive nature where he'll chase something as long and as hard as it needs to be chased to find it out. He's great at gathering detail, and he had a foundation for this book going for years that he was building on. And you know, he helped me with my last book, The Beach Boys FAQ, with one part of that book that was specifically about live shows. And so in that, time that we spent together working on that, we sort of talked about his dream of getting Beach Boys Concerts book, completed and out. And, conversations turned into more kind of like ideas, shooting ideas back and forth. And I finally had him send me all of his everything that he had, all of his research, and the kind of raw form that it was in. I really saw the potential of it, and I told him I would love to collaborate on turning this thing into a book. And I thought that I had a good outlet for it with Backbeat Books and the editor that I had worked there, with there on my previous book. So that's how it got going. And once Ian and I really turned our full attention to this, knowing that we had a publisher interested, then it became a true collaboration and putting the pieces together and writing and rewriting and polishing it into a book.
Well, polish is a good word for the presentation of the book. Beautiful hardcover, beautiful colors. Reads to me a bit like a website. I mean, that is a compliment in terms of the center columns. So when you open the book, sidebars, photos, many of which I've never seen, and a lot of posters, and even business cards, and all. It's almost a one-stop shop. So you and Ian and the publishers have done a phenomenal job. Congratulations, and
well,
thank you.
And
some folks may think that sounds a little ingenuous, but Beach Boy fans appreciate the kind of work it takes to, my phrase is to kind of not only preserve the legacy, but to at least communicate the legacy, because so much about this particular band maybe has been done in a way that would not stand the sense of time and history. So this is a book that 25 years from now can still be used to introduce new folks to the life of the Beach Boys.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, and we're so pleased with the way that the care and just the deluxe nature that it was presented in. That's beyond our expectations. I pitched the idea to the publisher as a large format book, and they sort of went the extra mile and turned it into the beautiful thing that it is, with the hardback presentation and the glossy pages and all the color throughout. And we had to pinch ourselves, you know, when they told us this is how they were going to approach it. So is this really happening? Because, you know, if you notice, books in general are kind of getting smaller, less
yes.
colorful, you know, because, just the nature of business, that whole industry is shrinking. So for them to go all out on a book like this, it's a surprise and a really great one for us. And I love the way the book looks.
Well, you guys set the bar high in terms of your content and the quality of the content, and I think they matched it. So, we're all to benefit from that. The publishers that you're talking about put out a book maybe 10, 12 years ago that also tried to chronicle the Beach Boys tour. Why did you guys sense we needed another one? This is more than updates that, but what did they think, or what did you guys think that would make what you've done? Well, it is so fantastic, but what was the original thinking?
It's kind of an interesting story, because you're probably referring to the Keith Badman book.
Yes.
Which I can't recall what the title of it is, but it's something about the day-by-day or the ultimate, you know.
I think I'm looking at the title, The Definitive Diary of America's Greatest Band on Stage and in the Studio.
So there you go. So I always loved the look and the format of that book. I was so happy to buy that book when I saw it. And then, because it's just such an enjoyable format, and then we started realizing that so much of the information in it was wrong, and because I was researching other books at the time, other Beach Boys books, I think I was working on the David Marks book at the time that I got the Badman book, and so I was really heavily into the early touring period, writing David's book. And I just, you know, using that book as a reference, I was finding just all kinds of errors in it. And so I just knew that it was, you know, as beautiful as it was a badly researched book. And for whatever reason, I don't know, you know, I don't know how that happened. But obviously there's just tons and tons of misinformation in it. And so it's interesting that, you know, that it turns out to be Backbeat Books was a publisher of that book, which is the same publisher of the book that Ian and I just did. But the story is that I guess Backbeat was a kind of an independent publisher. I think they were based in the Bay Area, and San Francisco Bay Area. And I guess they had some kind of financial problems. I don't know, you know, the details of it all, but anyway, the Hal Leonard Group, which is a giant, publisher of music, not just music biographies, but if you were to buy sheet music, music books like, you know, on any of your favorite artists, even my kid taking piano lessons, you know, the books that her teacher gives her,
right,
they're all Hal Leonard published books, and so Hal Leonard is just a giant. They're based in New Jersey, and I think they have offices in Minnesota, but they pretty much dominate the entire, you know, music books, music biographies, and, you know, as far as sheet music and all that kind of thing, they kind of dominate that industry right now. And they ended up buying Backbeat Books I don't know if they went bankrupt or if they just wanted to sell.
Oh, okay.
And so when they absorbed Backbeat Books, the titles that were on Backbeat that they currently had stock on were absorbed basically by Hal Leonard and distributed. So that Badman book, you know, would have fallen into that category. So they didn't actually create that book or produce that book. They just sort of bought it after the fact.
Sure.
And in the pitch of our book, when I pitched the publisher on our book, one of the immediate things I said is there's a book you know, under your imprint in the market that is a direct competition for this book. But I have to tell you that it's going to be obsolete. It's going to be completely obsolete when our book comes out. And so at least, you know, from the sense of the touring end of things. And, yeah, so it wasn't a problem. They, you know, there was no hesitation. They were happy to have us swoop in and produce something that would you know, basically replace that book in a more correct and careful way. So,
well, I may be the only person interested in this question coming off of what you just said, but there's research, as maybe we've seen in the first, you know, the definitive diary that came out, but then there's research that you guys seem to, I'm not sure what word to use, you'll explain it, I hope, but you guys were able to not just get more accurate information, but I haven't read through the whole thing. It'll take me forever to do that, but wherever I land, if I'm reading a sidebar or I'm reading a particular description of a concert, there's information in there that I'm thinking, how did you guys had to be there to get that information. Where did you find this? So then there's newspaper quotes that somehow you or Ian found that fits with the particular show. It's almost like it was written in real time is what I'm trying to say, which I think is an extraordinary feat.
Yeah, it really gives you that sense of being there, and that, I think, really informs the reader. You really get great perspective on how their, you know, how their lives and how their career evolved in a way that's impossible to do in a typical narrative book. There's just so much nuance involved in you know, traveling from city to city with, you know, knowing about all the business implications and the political implications and just getting their gear there and the problems they had with the gear and the side musicians and the management and the, you know, road managers, and then they're dealing with the promoters and they're dealing with the audiences and reactions and then the reviewers and the critics and to have this like occurring as a day by day experience, you know, over the course of decades, it just gives you a perspective on how the, you know, how their career grew and shrunk and grew and survived in a way that it really is impossible to explain without really experiencing that in that way. And I really have to give that credit to Ian as far as just, you know, digging up the raw information, because he spent a lot of time in libraries going through microfiche, you know, looking at old newspapers, just with a hunch that the Beach Boys must have been in this market on this day in this year because they were in this other market, and it would be, you know, it would be logical that they would travel through this way, or he'd hear a rumor, or he'd see a poster and track it down that way. You know, and obviously interviewing people that were there, you get a lot of tips that way as well. But he collected all of this information, you know, regarding dates and places and times and venues, and then, you know, researching the venues, and then actually going and trying to talk to people from the venues that are still around and asking if they had anything left in the archives. And you'd be surprised how many places that he contacted, you know, say they played somewhere in Wisconsin in 1973 at a college or something, the college is still there, or, you know, some auditorium, it's still there. And so he's contacted that auditorium in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, and asked them, gee, the Beach Boys played there in 1973. Do you have anything in your files, any advertising, any photos, any information? And they would go and look and see, and usually it was no. You know, usually they would say that, you know, we threw out all those files, you know. But often, enough times to make it worthwhile, they would say, yeah, hang on a second, yes, we have some photographs, or we have concert tickets that were unsold, or we have an advertisement, or we have, you know, something. And then he would also, you know, looking through the papers, he would see, well, if they played there on the 4th, then it's logical the review would appear on the 5th. So he would go and look up the newspaper on the day after or the 2 days after they had performed in a certain market and see if he could find a review. And, you know, and then he would just archive over the course of years and years, he would archive all that stuff. And then he, you know, created a kind of a rough chronology and sort of handed that over to me. And you know, we added more stuff and we talked to more people and we used some of my stuff and from my archive as well, and my photographs as well. And you know, the more the merrier.
Right.
And, you know, it's amazing how it came together. But, yeah, as far as that process of how would you even know that? How would you, you know, a lot of it was him doing that, just that legwork, you know. Some of the things from the earliest days, I had learned through writing my other books and writing David's book. Dave's mom had a tour journal. Dave's dad was a tour manager for the Beach Boys on some of their tours. So we could also access that to get information about some of the early days. And, you know, we talked to a lot of the people who were around in those years. And some really interesting people that, you know, no one has really tapped yet for any Beach Boys books. So I think, you know, you'll see some names pop up of some sidemen and some maybe road managers or promoters in management, Beach Boys management, that, you know, people hadn't really interviewed before. So that's another interesting perspective, is you're getting kind of a new take from different people.
Yeah, it really is almost a kaleidoscope of perspectives in real time. It's just amazing. And wherever I jump in, kind of parachute in and read something, oftentimes, and again, I've not read the entire book yet, but I'm like, yeah, I knew about this. But when it's kind of all juxtaposed together, the show, the city, the date, the sidebar, kind of expanding on some of this, I'll have you talk about that in a minute. It just helps put things together, like the release of Then I Kissed Her in England. When they were there, they had just won the award as the, you know, world's top group, yet the disappointment that comes from the press and the fans of that song rather than a Pet Sounds type song. I mean, so it's just fun to dive deep into it, even just by reading one show or one page of a, you know, a brief tour. You guys have done an amazing job of putting all that together. The strategy and the tactics of that, though, are, you know, the strategy is simple, just interview everybody in the world you can or research, but to go after all that stuff, the tenacity that you guys have put out is just unparalleled, I think, in anybody chronicling Beach Boy history to this point.
Yeah, and again, this is the kind of person Ian is. If you meet him and talk to him, he's ready to put his energy in, you know, whereas most people would, you know, I mean, I've written, well, this is my fourth Beach Boys related book. And I've usually, you know, I've done a ton of interviews for those books, but the previous three books I've written have been more of a, well, the FAQ book is kind of vignettes, but the other two books were biographies, typical style, and you're writing a narrative, you're trying to tell a story, basically. And the FAQ book has kind of a series of little shorter stories, but this book, it's the total of all the little tiny parts put together that really give you what the story is. And like I said before, it's almost an indescribable story. It, you know, without experiencing it in that way, you can say, oh, well, they were, you know, they were kind of a local band that became a phenomenon. And, you know, they were the biggest rock band in America. And then it all kind of, you know, then they kind of fell out of favor. They suddenly became yesterday's news. And it took them a while to adjust and recover. And then, you know, they found their way back to the top again and were even bigger. So you can say it like that, but to take that ride, that day by day ride through that, and how all of the reasons why that happened, because it's, they'll say, well, why were they unpopular? Well, they kept wearing the striped shirts for too long, or people labeled them as a surf band, and you know, surf bands, you know, hot rod bands became unpopular, you know, and yeah, those are you know, two things on a list of, you know, 300 that are you know, that could be considered why, but the real why is all in that book, you know, that you described. I mean, it's all there, and it's just so many little pieces and parts.
I think it helps somebody, the word confluence comes to mind, like, you know, it's true, they kept wearing striped shirts too long, but that certainly wasn't the only thing, and the day-by-day stuff that you guys put out, what I'm calling the narrative on the side, you may, you know, explain that differently, but just the ongoing narrative on the side, that just helps people put it in context of not just the Beach Boys, not just top 40 music, but really what's going on in the country. Not that this is a sociological study, but that flair is there. And even personally for me, I mean, I grew up with this stuff and went through all those phases with them. And so, I don't know, in a corny way, this validates some of the thoughts I had along the way as to, you know, mistakes they were making, or why the culture was missing some great music, and Darlin' should have been a number one hit, and no one played it, and, you know, all that kind of stuff that I lived through. This is giving some foundation and even validation to it in terms of my view that really never stopped producing great music.
Well, I certainly agree with you and your description of, you know, that, because they were really overlooked. It's incredible, but maybe when they were at their best, they were the most overlooked. I mean, in a way, you could say
yes. You
could say that the surf that the Sunflower period may have been their strongest period as a group, as a total force, creatively. And the single Darlin', you know, was, you know, just a R&B blue-eyed soul masterpiece, you know, just pop soul masterpiece. And yeah, absolutely. It did okay, but if, you know, if they hadn't been the Beach Boys, it probably would have been a number one, or at least the top 10. And it's like, there's a whole string of that happening to them. And it's weird. It's like, there's kind of a delay in the public's, especially in America, the public kind of catches up to them late, in a way, you know, re-catches up to them. I mean, because they were such a phenomenon, and that's the other thing people don't, people tend to write off the early years a lot. You know, they tend to label those early albums as being simplistic, and you know, it's really not until maybe 65, 66, you know, that people start taking their music seriously, I guess. That's not the case for me. You know, I grew up in real time as well. I was really very young. My first Beach Boys record, I saw my first Beach Boys album in 63 when I was about 5 years old, or 6 years old, but I remember because my sisters were teenagers, and those were very important records around our house. They got played all the time, and surf, you know, I remember when Surfing USA was the new record in our house, and it was exciting. It was really exciting, but I also had the perspective on how big they were. They were huge, and you know, they were household names. And I don't know who we compare them to in the modern age, but at that time they were on a par with the Beatles. Of course, you know, the Beatles eclipsed everything, but it was that kind of, that level of fame. There was definitely a Beach Boys mania happening in the States, and they were being, you know, you read those entries from those tours in 64 and 65, they're being torn apart, you know, every place they go. The stages are being rushed. There's riots. It's just like, you know, a Beatlemania, or, you know, the mania that was Bobby Soxer mania that there was for Sinatra in the mania there was for Elvis, they had, you know, they had that kind of thing going in that period. And so I can't remember what the point I was going to try to make, but they were a serious force at that point. And
yeah, were pointing out that their early career, while certainly those albums are different or simpler maybe than you know, a Pet Sounds or a Smile, it in its context and in its time, it was more than top of the charts. I mean, it was groundbreaking. The fact that
super groundbreaking.
Just the fact that Capitol let them put, frankly, they did a couple of covers on some of those early albums, but most of the songs were their own. I mean, that's unheard of for any teen group, and they were about to surpass that that whole title.
And they created, you know, that's the other thing that people rarely talk about, is that there was no market for rock and roll albums. Rock and roll was a singles market. The only real album artist in rock and roll was Elvis, and he sold a lot of albums. You know, the Ricky Nelson sold albums, but he's, you know, kind of more of a teen idol than a rocker, but but there wasn't really an album market until the Beach Boys came along, and those albums preceded the Beatles in America. Sort of laid the foundation for how Capitol marketed the Beatles, and in the, you know, selling millions of albums. The Beach Boys were. I'm sorry.
You go ahead.
Well, the Beach Boys were there first. They were.
Yeah.
They had you know, become this mega selling rock and roll group that wasn't only a singles group, but they were selling, you know, huge numbers of LPs, and so just for that, they were a serious force in the business, and as you said, innovative, groundbreaking in so many ways, you know, because they were self-contained, they played their own instruments, they sang all that, you know, complicated stuff, Brian wrote the songs, Mike wrote the lyrics, and they produced Brian produced and arranged these records, and it's like, instead of a team of people, you know, putting together something to market to the teen market, to the youth market, the Beach Boys were just like this monster that came out of nowhere and created this whole new thing that really hadn't been done.
When I interviewed you before, one of the things I thought of was, if I have this right, I think their concert album might have gone to number one. I'm not remembering precisely, but just the fact that a live concert album, I mean, that was somewhat groundbreaking as well, certainly for a rock group. And my little research has said that they even had to tone down the screaming because it was a mania type of situation. So I think the fact that the Beatles hit so big and worldwide that even if the Beach Boys were number two, everybody thinks number two is just, you know, down at the bottom. And as you're pointing out, it really wasn't. And this book, and certainly some of the stuff you put in your other books, helps put them, I think, in a proper context. It's what you're doing for the Beach Boys is helping people who are going to be serious fans of them in the future better understand them. It's not like Tiger Beat magazine just trying to do a puff piece. It's hard research. It's valid analysis. It's not a subjective fan who just loves their songs, but it's hard but fair analysis. And I think, again, I keep saying this, but, you know, 25, 50 years from now, if the world's still around here, folks who are listening to the Beach Boys will be able to better enjoy that music because of the kind of stuff they can read in, well, all of your books and certainly this one that you and Ian have worked on together.
Well, this one would definitely be a great textbook if somebody was to teach a Beach Boys class. I think it would be an excellent text just because it is so research heavy and they're just, you know, the details sort of, instead of having so much opinion, which my other books definitely are heavy on, one is more or less, you know, draw your own conclusion. Because here's what, you know, here's how many tickets they sold, here's how much money they made, here's the songs they did that night. You know, here's what the local guy that wrote about them from this newspaper said. Here's what the fan who attended the concert had to say. Here's what the guy, you know, who played keyboards on that tour had to say about it. And you get, you know, you get kind of some divergent perspective there. I mean, you can go from town to town where the one guy will just say they're awful. They're just, they could not sing, they couldn't play their instruments, and the next guy will say they're the most brilliant thing he's ever seen. And,
yeah.
You know, and it can be a day apart.
Yeah. You said something in that long list of things that you guys have put together for the book, the songs they sang. I think that's something that readers will really enjoy. And again, I've just hop, skipped, and jumped so far. But to not just know that, okay, they played, you know, I'm Chicago, so, you know, here's the show I went to in Chicago. But, you know, in most cases, you've got the opening acts there, that maybe there's some comments, but in many cases, you've got at least some of the set list. And surprising to me, in a couple spots, I went, hey, here's Dennis doing Little Bird. I mean, I'd love to have heard that live, you know, one of my favorite songs of theirs, certainly.
Yeah,
for
surprising.
Just 40
some
Beach
of the,
Boys, it's kind
surprising
of
some of the material that pops up that you've forgotten or it hasn't been written about that they actually performed. Some definitely some unrecorded things too by Dennis that snuck into the set list there. I think there was a lot of revelation for me putting this together. I was learning things that I did not know. I think one of the ones that surprised me was that he sang Forever at a show as late as, I think, 73. And they had, like, I think they had a children's choir or something, you know, singing along with them, or a string quartet or some kind of, there was some oddity to the performance,
right.
But it just was out of the blue that they put Forever into a set in, you know, really late. Because I think I think of that song as being basically gone by 71.
You're saying Forever, I think. Did you mean Little Bird?
No, Forever.
Oh. Okay.
I did mean, but yeah, Little Bird too. Surprising, they did do that on a tour in '68. And you know what? I don't know if I'm. I think it's pretty much common knowledge. I think they released the track list, but I believe the live version of Little Bird is going to be on the Made in California box, which will be
nice. I hope so. I mean,
because
that
I've heard it, and
it's a thrill for me.
It's great.
Yeah.
You'll love it. It's got Brown.
But what also is cool about, I mean, that's just, you know, some Beach Boy fans, of course, might say, well, that's interesting. Thank you. No, thank you. But it helps give, like you said, some revelation. There's a revelation that, you know, during that time period, everybody was kind of thinking they were just being a jukebox band, or they weren't being experimental, or, you know, they just kind of went through the motions. I mean, I think they did a tremendous amount of experimenting and attempting to, you know, perform live in a quality way what they were producing on records. And, you know,
Phil, have you read?
Helps see that.
Have you read any of the bits from 72 and around that period where they're, you know, where they're literally getting into shouting matches with, you know, with the audience over the songs?
I've got some of that previous anecdotal stuff, but no, I haven't hit that in.
Yeah. When you hit
yet.
That, it's really surprising because, you know, how intense it got, between them and the audience in some places where, you know, literally the audience is screaming, you know, that we're gonna walk out, you know, if you don't play Barbara Ann, and they're just, the Beach Boys are basically saying, go ahead, you know, go ahead, walk out.
Yeah.
We don't care. We're gonna play Long Promised Road. You can wait. We'll do Surfing USA in the encore, but for now, just shut up, you know. And this is literally how it's going for them. And it's some cities it's okay. Maybe when they're more on the East Coast, I don't know if they have a more refined attitude or whatever, but it seems like they're a little more open to hearing newer material. But there's some markets they would get into where it just got to be, you know, the audience got to be so disrespectful, and it's town after town, and you know, you can see it's wearing on them. But they're still trying. They're introducing he's, you know, the traitor and only with you and all these things into the, you know, Funky Pretty and Marcella. They're introducing all this stuff into the set. And people are just sitting on their hands through that stuff and just, you know, screaming, "Help me, Rhonda," you know. So, yeah, they did try. You're right. They really tried hard to keep being a band that was producing new material and progressing. And it just got to be, you know, the progress was being made. They were growing. Things like Sail on Sailor, you know, helped because it got radio play. But, you know, they were growing incrementally. They were kind of coming out of, I'd say the low point was 70, 71,
mm-hmm.
popularity-wise for them. And they kind of had regained their footing by 73. And instead of playing, you know, college gymnasiums and high school gymnasiums, they started playing halls and arenas again. So, you know, just the evidence of the venues they're playing, it's pre-Endless Summer. They were already getting bigger and coming back. But then by the time Endless Summer came around, it just sort of, you know, it was pretty much like they decided to stop fighting. They just decided to stop fighting it and load up the set with the songs people wanted to hear and, you know, front load. They used to sort of try to save, they'd do two sets or maybe even two and a half, and they'd try to save the oldies for the last part of the show. But that made the first part of the show a very, you know, weird experience because of everybody just constantly yelling out requests. And so, so that was the big change in 74. You know, they just said, okay, well, we're going to open with California Girls, you know, just get it over with.
Yeah. I remember experiencing some of that, changes that, you know, that wave of up and down. Hindsight's certainly 2020, but, and no pun intended with the Beach Boy open there, but, you know, Brian having toured with the Pet Sounds tour, the Smile tour, I wonder if in the future there might be, you know, when there are no original Beach Boys left, they'll hopefully license some very good groups to go around and represent the music, but I wonder if some of them will be, this is the Summer Days, Summer Nights concert where you'll get that whole album plus other things, or this is Holland, or this is Holland and Sunflower. I just hope that they don't mash everything together so that some of those great songs that you've mentioned and others kind of just never make the set list.
Yeah, I mean, did you see any of the 50th tour?
Yes.
Okay.
The Chicago show.
So you're probably pleasantly surprised that they put some things in that set that
Absolutely.
You may not have expected. I know. Absolutely. I was.
Yes.
I think they kind of wonder why people, you know, people are that interested in songs that weren't hits and were just kind of forgotten album tracks, I think. But then I think when they hear them, they realize, wow, you know, this really was, you know, Please Let Me Wonder really was a, you know, killer song. Add Some Music was a, you know, it's a really interesting song and arrangement. And so, you know, that, I mean, if you just take the hits and the well-known songs of the Beach Boys, their catalog is incredibly deep. And to know that you can even go, you know, much deeper than that and still be finding things like, you know, Girl Don't Tell Me, you know, which is just,
yeah.
You know, just an amazing, great, great song that, you know, a lot of people would never know that song. I mean, I have a friend who's a Beach Boys fan, has a bunch of their stuff, and I just turned him on to that song. He was, like, completely unaware. If you can believe somebody being a Beach Boys fan and being unaware of that song this far down the line. But you know, and I sent him a YouTube link, you know, that, and I said, you should listen to this song. And he was blown away. It's like, wow, you know.
Well, then even a song that really technically, and maybe it's been released in some form now, but Can't Wait Too Long. I mean, songs that, you know, like that, if you listen to them, it's like, this could have been a hit, or if it's certainly a great song to listen to.
It has elements
so.
that you would think they could have shaped it somehow to maybe enhance the parts. You know, there is a very beautiful commercial kind of part to that track, yeah. But it seemed like Brian especially got into the, I don't know if it's a habit, if I would call it a habit, but he just seemed to get into a routine of kind of always, you know, having some beauty and then having some kind of weird clunky dissonance as well that, you know, sort of takes something into the non-commercial zone. And I don't know why, but you know, I mean, I like it all, so I'm not really complaining. I'm not
no,
really.
No, me either.
it's just more eclectic, and it's not.
Yeah.
Probably drives Mike up the wall because he can hear the potential if we had just, you know, shortened this down to a verse chorus, you know, kind of song instead of having like all this weirdness in it, that it would be a song. But I know Brian was more interested in expressing himself in immediately, and then in worrying about too much about how things were structured, I think.
So, John, someone who's not even born yet, growing up, and how will they be introduced to the Beach Boys? I mean, obviously, you and I am about 10 years before you, but in terms of age, but we both went through these various periods in real time. But someone who, you know, the real time is decades past, do you think it'll still be people will start by buying Greatest Hits, then maybe a Sunflower or a Summer Days or Today or something? Or because of the iTunes, who knows what it'll be, the music will be, how it will be accessible even 5 years from now. But currently the iTunes kind of catalog where you can just pick and choose, you can make your own playlist kind of thing, or Pandora, you don't even have to buy, you just, you know, kind of, showing what you like. How will people be introduced to their music, and do you think that will make a difference? Kind of crystal ball, but what do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, my hope would be that they would be thought of as innovators and you know, something that was so spiritually connected to whatever, and, you know, I'm not going to try to explain it, but there's an essence in a lot of their music that is beyond what so many artists have been able to achieve. They're one of a handful of artists that tapped into this, you know, very spiritual thing.
Yes.
That just you can just feel it in your bones. However Brian connected with music and expressed it, and I would hope that's how they're perceived, and it's not the corny, commercial, catchy, you know. But again, they bring a lot of joy and a lot of pleasure to people for those reasons as well, because of the good time. And the harmonies and the sunshine and the subject matter and their songs and all of those things and their iconic songs. I mean, David Marks would tell you that it's an intergenerational thing that little kids and you know, grandparents all connect to, because there's a joy and whatever. But I think even in some of the darker material, there still is this spiritual, unexplainable kind of entity in their music, and I would hope, you know, that it's that more sophisticated side of them that is remembered and appreciated, the innovative side. I mean, there's so much innovation, but when you ask that question, I think, you know, I'm such a non-expert on you know, how the, you know, kind of social perceptions are going to evolve. But I can give you an example as to, you know, how they're kind of perceived by a younger slice of of our society now, and that is through their songs appearing in film. Wouldn't it be nice? It's probably could, you know. Wouldn't it be nice? Might be their most popular song right now, and the reason is because it appeared in, you know, several films over the last 10 years or so that people, you know, really related to, and they get played and played again on HBO and whatever, and so that song is constantly getting, you know, recycled and played, and it's such a great song that all you have to do is hear it, you know, two or three times, and you're basically hooked for life.
yes.
And so when they, you know, they played Bonnaroo, huge festival, and mostly 20-somethings to 30-somethings attending, and I think they, you know, they had 40,000 people standing there watching them, and, you know, everybody was happy to hear Surfin' USA, and everybody was happy to hear Good Vibrations and all that stuff. They got great reaction. But it's when they played Wouldn't It Be Nice that the crowd absolutely went, you know, I'm not going to say the, I was going to say ape something, but the crowd went absolutely crazy for them.
Yeah.
You know, and Wouldn't It Be Nice has that kind of hipster connotation in that it's a Pet Sounds track, and we know that, you know, that a lot of music, you know, intelligentsia or however you would say that word, of course, you know, think of Pet Sounds as being a pinnacle, that song being one of the major parts of Pet Sounds. And then that song also having a life of its own in the, you know, social sort of, you know, modern day social movie media, you know, television experience. So you know, kind of apply that, I guess, experience to the future and whatever it's going to be, whatever people are watching or listening to, whatever, you know, the media experience is at that time. If their music is somehow woven into that experience, then I think it will always stand out in its own way, just because it's, you know, like I said before, it's just so innovative. I don't think there is a higher experience in pop music than maybe the song Surf's Up, you know. I don't think that the form evolved any further than that, because that is an operatic, classical, you know, masterpiece that is still in a pop rock format, you know, with guitar, bass, drums, keyboards, and, you know, whatever else it has on it, you know. But the song is just so beautifully composed, arranged, and performed. I don't think anybody ever got any, you know, any better than that. In my opinion.
I think you're right. I remember when I'm a church kid, and we had a youth group the night that Leonard Bernstein was to show Brian singing it on TV, and I was trying to figure a way how to get out of the meeting so I could go hear this, because you just knew it wasn't just, this is my favorite group, I want to hear, you know, they're on TV, isn't that cool? But you just knew that this was something very special. And I still get goosebumps as you start talking about it, just remembering that moment. You know, I knew where I was. Like, it's kind of sorry to use this illustration, but it's kind of a Kennedy assassination thing. And when you heard about it, you knew where you were. I mean, this is just that powerful, at least for me, you know, going through this in real time.
That's an incredible memory, and probably a pretty rare one for people to actually remember that. I could give you I remember something like getting the All Summer Long album, you know, when it came out, and what that experience was like for me. But something like Leonard Bernstein and Surf's Up would be a little bit more obscure, in my, you know, that's something I would have learned about after the fact. But again, that the, you know, the artistic plateau that he was reaching at that time, I say he because it's mainly Brian, but again, I don't ever like to give the other guys, you know, I always want to give them their just due, because I really do think that that it was all essential. I think every piece of it was
absolutely
essential. And it's part of why it's so great. But yeah, that song in particular just really blows my mind. It still does. How did he get to that place? You know, I mean, it's just such a,
yeah,
such a beautiful melody, such a beautiful performance, and just, you know, with Van Dyke's lyrics, there's such a mystery about that song. I don't think it will ever be fully understood. And I really, you know, as I said before, in my opinion, my humble opinion, I don't think, you know, I try to name another artist that got, you know, that got to that level of sophistication. And when you think about that, it's like Brian's not a very sophisticated guy, really. He just, you know, I mean, to be honest, you know, he just isn't. His whole thing is he's a very simple guy, and, you know, very flawed guy, but his heart is so tapped in to what he's creating when he's creating it, that you hear things on a, you know, completely different level.
Yeah.
Than you do with most artists who are more self-conscious about what, you know, how they're creating, and why they're creating, and what they're trying to, you know, what they're trying to put forth, and how that's going to be perceived, and all these kinds of issues. Whereas with him, he's just going after, you know, this, you know, he's just going after the sound. He doesn't really know where it's coming from, but he can hear it in his head, and he's going after it as quickly as he can to try to get to it. And,
well, and for a guy that some would say is socially, I don't know, not trying to be negative to him, but, you know, he's not a genius thinker in terms of philosophy or anything, the guy who can write Hey Little Tomboy, to be able to pour his heart out, like you say, and for something not just beautiful, but for something, you know, a strong statement, you know, Till I Die, some of the others that you mentioned, the darker side. So many groups back in that day, when they didn't get spiritual, but maybe got religion and did some of the Devil's Banquet stuff and all the, you know, dark, evil stuff. I don't know if they're just using it as, you know, fodder for topics, or if they really believed it. But even when Brian got so-called dark, it wasn't, it was just about true human feelings and the depth of our need, and I would say our need for God. Anyway, just that ability for someone who maybe, and sometimes people think of as just very simple, being so sophisticated with thought as well as sound.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's, you know, I always come back to heart. And, you know, that's just another word I'm just using to describe whatever that indescribable thing is. It's humanity. It's feeling, you know, real feeling. And I don't pretend to really understand him at all. I don't know Brian that well. I've met him many times and, you know, listened to his music probably more than is healthy.
But, I got to steal that phrase because I've done the same thing.
Yeah. But I, you know, as far as like understanding that guy, you know, I don't think I could even come close. I think he's as complex as things about him are. I think he's essentially a more simple person than most people would ever imagine. Considering, you know, listening to something like Pet Sounds, how could just a regular guy have created that? But I do think in a way he is, you know, a somewhat childlike regular kind of guy, and didn't really get it. For whatever reason, he didn't develop in a way that most people would call normal. I think a lot of it has to do, you know, where that special place that he taps into and reaches for. I think Dennis had it too, and I think, you know, I think they all had it. They could all create it as a team. Brian obviously had it in a, you know, a higher level or a more accessible level than any of them. But I, you know, what I'm getting to is that I think it kind of goes back to Murray. I think as all the negative things we hear about Murray, but I think one of the positive ones is that he taught, when he taught his kids to fall in love with music, when his kids, you know, and maybe we should give Audrey credit as well, however they fell in love with music, they saw music as more than just having fun and making a sound. They saw music as a connection to something really, really deep and important inside of them. And you can feel it when they perform. I always say there's a sincerity, an earnest is the word I think about. There's an earnest nature, or earnestness in how they sing and how the Wilson brothers sing, all of them, and in certainly the other guys as well. And
personal anecdote on how true that is. Back in the 60s, ran into Carl after a concert in a garage, and all I could say to him, because he's heading out, is I can hear music had just come out, and they sang it. And I said, hey, great job, love the song. And it was like he stopped for a moment and wasn't just being nice to a fan saying thank you, but it was like that meant something to him because of what you're saying, that it's more than just, that's our next song that's out and we're performing it, but he really seemed to care.
And you can hear it in that song. I mean, it's just, it gives you goosebumps, right? There's something about it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not because it's so catchy or, you know, so it's got such a great beat or, you know, it has those things, but it's something about within the performance, within the vocal performance of the song, there's something really human that's happening in there. And it's that way with so much of their stuff. And I always think it had to have been Murray because those boys took him so seriously. There's so much of their what was good and bad about them, or which was successful and the failures about them, were wrapped up in that guy, were wrapped up in their dad. And you know, your father is your father, and they held him in high regard in a lot of ways, and they, you know, I think they were abused or, you know, ashamed of him, or and they thought he was out of time, you know, past, you know, someone who you wouldn't take seriously because he was part of yesterday in a lot of ways as well. But I think that there's something in the essence of when they began and when they fell in love with music that he was a big part of, and somehow that was unveiled to them through his eyes and through, you know, his perspective in a way that imprinted something on them that made them, you know, take it, you know, in a deeper way, or, you know, words don't really work, but if you listen to the music and you really connect with it, then
I think I know
what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, and being a musical family, actually all of them having some kind of musical context to their family, that had something to do with it for sure. For me, obviously I'm not objective. I'm a pastor, so I look for this stuff. But, you know, the fact that they grew up for a while anyway in a church, I mean, so many of their songs, for me, take me back to church. I'm having a spiritual experience.
Well, isn't that what Van Dyke says about them in the I think, is it the American Band documentary? Or maybe it's the...
Yeah.
It's Okay
maybe TV that was,
special,
yeah,
but he basically says it's about church. It's their church people, and
yeah,
they come from that. You know, I grew up in Catholic church, and you know, we obviously had a lot of music going on and
sure,
as well in that. So I mean, I can kind of relate, but yeah, I mean, I can see that however you want to rationalize it, and we can all take a shot at it, but none
yeah,
of us are really. But you definitely would have to say there's a spiritual element to their to their music.
Well, a couple quick questions before we roll this up. One of them maybe hard to answer, but we talked a little bit about the future. Someone 25, 50 years from now, what would be their, I think your book would be their best introduction to the Beach Boys. What kind? Is there a particular song? Would Surf's Up be the one you'd want to introduce them to? I know that's an impossible question to answer. I think one of my favorites that kind of bridges between some of the early stuff, the hits, as well as some of the more sophisticated stuff would be Little Girl I Once Knew, which from a top 40 point of view got totally lost in the shuffle, sad to say. But any song come to your mind or a way to introduce?
Oh, man, I just love so much of their work. And I really love the guitar work on the early stuff and just the garage band, the rawness. And,
yeah.
And then, you know, the later stuff when it gets more sophisticated and, you know, just the smile is just so avant-garde and Pet Sounds is so dense and so much creativity. And, you know, it's too hard to choose for me, but
absolutely.
But I will. And
okay,
I will say,
good.
I will say the album All Summer Long is probably to me the most perfect statement that they ever made. That it's, you know, they're still kind of a garage band, but they're starting to find some sophistication. You can kind of see their,
sure,
you know, they're somehow that album is nostalgic, which is interesting because it's 1964 and they're already, you know, something like Do You Remember?
Yeah, yeah.
And even the song All Summer Long has a nostalgic element to it because they're lamenting the passing of this thing, you know. And you know, the summer as an entity, you know, they're really sorry to see it going, and it immediately gives that album a kind of a nostalgic feel. Hushabye.
Mm.
And, you know, I always think of even Wendy as having a 50s throwback kind of feel to it because it's like lines like "We went together for so long." It was right, that's right out of like a doo-wop, you know, kind of a
yes.
song. And so I kind of like the way that All Summer Long is of its time because it's, you know, it's very electric and progressing into the 60s, and it's, you know, something like I Get Around is competing and winning against the Beatles. But again, you still have this 50s kind of nostalgia happening in it as well. I mean, to me, it's just, it's brilliant. And it really defines what the Beach Boys were and are to me. And so that's what I would pick as an album. As a single song, man, that would just be almost impossible.
That's impossible. Yeah. Well, one other thing, I was as I was getting ready to talk with you, I just wanted to look through the book, even though I've not finished reading it, and see how many pages. You know that you are 2 pages short of 409.
I was so mad when I saw that. I pointed that out to my wife, and it was just like, oh. They told me it was going to be 400 pages. If they had told me it was going to be 407, I would have forced them to make it 409.
But, sure, a couple more photos, something.
Something, yeah. I know. I was originally told it was going to be 400 on the button. So I think maybe just hand number those last 2 blank pages there, and you know.
I'll do that, and I'll hold off to one day get your autograph on them. How's that?
Okay, that sounds good.
That'd be great. Well, John, thanks. Maybe sometime we can jump on the phone again like this. And for me, we've just kind of scratched the surface and would love to talk to you again sometime if we could ever arrange that.
Yeah, I guess you probably figured out by now I can go on and on a little bit about the Beach Boys, but
well,
I do. I really enjoyed this, Phil. It was fun talking to you.
Well, and I with you. So we'll don't hang up, but we'll close this off in a second. Just John, is there a website where folks, you would draw folks to for your books or?
I have a website that is run by a great lady named Carol Dreyer, who I want to give a shout out to. She's known as Web Granny. And the site is thejohnstebbins.com. So www.thejohnstebbins.com.
Sounds good. Hope some folks who haven't read Beach Boys FAQ or your Dennis Wilson Real Beach Boy or David Mark's Lost Beach Boy, I mean, just everything you've done really is you raised, as I said earlier, you raised the bar high, and you and Ian on this one, and it's material that will remain and help people get an accurate view of this phenomenal group, the amazing, not just music, but amazing lives. So thanks for taking some time to talk with me about it, and Pray for Surf. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Bill.